Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the September 23rd edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swain, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist and author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for your hospitality. We're doing a switch up here. I'm in New York in your New York City office on Lexington Avenue. Lexington Avenue, right? Avenue?
Yes. You can call it Lex if you want to be a New Yorker.
The New Yorkers told me I was looking for Lex. Yeah. So very nice,
man. It's time to say Lexington, right? It's just Lex.
So many syllables. So many syllables. First of all, I just wanted to say thank you, dear podcast listeners, for being so patient. I was in Europe, as some of you might recall. I was visiting our son in Germany, where he got married to a wonderful German girl. And then we spent a couple of nights in Paris, the wife and I, for our anniversary. And now here I am in New York City. So good to be with you guys. David.
Hey, Will, congratulations on the wedding, the family, the trip. That's fantastic, man. I hope everybody enjoyed the time and that it was a joyful memory for the Swain family.
It is, and it's still going on. I mean, the kids and others all went to Oktoberfest. Heather and I headed out to Paris for our anniversary. And, you know, every time I see Paris, it's like seeing the Grand Canyon. It is so magnificent, so grand, and yet I'm always so glad to be home. Paris is an awful lot like, I think, what California aspires to be. They're prohibiting cars. Just like Gavin Newsom is truly a global leader or a global follower. So I've got that to look forward to in Paris. David, do you mind if I just sort of make a slight correction to some of my comments about Prop 30 from our conversation last week about ballot measures?
No, I'm curious to hear what you have to say. Go ahead.
Well, a couple of listeners, especially listener Ken up in the Bay Area, got me some documents that, you know, were all over the place, and I ought to have found them perhaps on my own. But they include a letter from Lyft's CEO to CARB, the California Air Resources Board. And it's fascinating because what Lyft was really trying to tell people, this is going back to 2021, so a little over a year ago in May of 2021, Lyft writes this letter. It's actually from Paul Augustine, Senior Manager Sustainability. And he says, "We're so glad that we can participate in this conversation with CARB. We sure do admire, you know, your deep desire to roll back climate change." And then he says, it's a very brief letter. I'll put it in the show notes. He says, "To further improve the proposed regulation and to prevent disproportionate impacts of the regulations on low and moderate income drivers, Lyft recommends that CARB meet the requirements of the Senate bill by establishing explicit mechanisms to ensure that targets are and remain technically and economically feasible and that they adapt existing incentives and develop new ones to support electrification." What they're really saying is, reality check, government. You guys want to do all these amazing things, but you're not taking into account the fact that many of our drivers are low-income people. They'll be hit harshest by this stuff. And you're not even building the infrastructure that would support an all-electric vehicle fleet. Now, all of this comes out of CARB's requirement that Lyft and Uber and similar gig economy companies that work with drivers are committed to 100% electric vehicles by 2030. And Lyft is just saying, look, if you want us to hit this thing, you're going to have to provide the infrastructure and you have to make sure that you don't impose regulations that just punish the poor, which seems very, very straightforward. But after a short, you know, sort of a delay, everything seemed fine. Lyft felt that it was heard. The Air Resources Board came back, approved the mandate, and Lyft saw it as absolutely punishing the poor. And the response of climate activists was, no, it doesn't, because Lyft, you have to bail them all out. You have to support their cars. You have to support electrification. This is all going to be on you if you want electric vehicle, if you want to meet the standard. So in other words, the state was saying, we're going to ignore your request to really make sure there's an electric utility infrastructure in place. We're going to ignore your concern about poor drivers by simply putting that responsibility back onto you, even though this is a new state requirement. Lyft's response was, let me see, in a letter the board, Lyft sent to the board, the company was more assertive, quote, while we're pleased to see aggressive environmental targets, we're disappointed that the efforts of the past years have culminated in metaphorical sticks with no carrots. In other words, you guys have just come back with the same stuff you started with. You didn't take any of our comments seriously, and we're left in a position to have to sort this out on our own. Hence, Prop 30, which regular listeners and those who really watch California's ballot measures for the November election will recall. Prop 30 is a tax on people with personal incomes over $2 million per year, an increase of 1.75%. I'm sorry, it's an additional 1.75% of income over $2 million. And Lyft says, we're going to use all this to support electrification of the utility system, the infrastructure in California. Oh, and by the way, we're going to give some money to the firefighters. They get the firefighters on board because firefighters like to get money too, just like everybody else does. But of course, who comes out against Prop 30 when Lyft says, look, you're not going to do anything to help our drivers. You're not going to do anything to build the infrastructure. So we're going to do it as a private company by going direct to the voters. And Newsom and the California Teachers Association say, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Ripping off the rich, that's our deal. So, David, just wanted to make sure that we were really, like, I don't think I gave.
You're not changing your opposition to 30 view. You're just providing more context as to where it came from.
Yeah. And I actually think that I understand much more that Lyft felt that if the state's not going to really build a robust utility system to support electric vehicles, and if they're going to just roll this thing out without regard to working class drivers, then this should come out of a tax, and a tax particularly that Newsom would oppose. Word on the street from our friend, some of our listeners was that Lyft really did aim this right at the CTA and at Gavin Newsom and say, you know, you think you're the only people who can run around talking about make the rich pay their fair share stuff. We're going to do that too. So I'm still opposed to it. It's still a tax hike. But the problem is, I think the nuance here is just that, again, CTA and Newsom are just in a racket. They're running a racket here and they don't want Lyft cutting in on their turf.
Okay, I mean, yeah, the fact that Lyft would propose something really bad because of other circumstances that themselves are really bad that they didn't create doesn't do a lot for me. And in fact, it does expose the hypocrisy that, like, for example, CTA wants egregious tax increases for their evil ends. But one could argue that it is still playing into the class warfare argument. Like you're saying, well, we need more money for electrification, and certainly we have an unlimited pot of infinite marginal rate room for the wealthy. And I will say this as a Laffer's Curve supply sider. They will get less money from that tax hike.
Yes, they will. And that's why, like you, I continue to oppose Prop 30. I think this deeper dive shows the dysfunctional response to a dysfunctional policy. It's just the way California politics work. We are a dysfunctional state, almost a failed state at this point, despite what our governor says. So anyway, I found that fascinating. There is lighter news that I would like to talk with you about, David. While yours truly was in Europe, so too was Nancy Pelosi. Now, Nancy has showed up in Kiev already, Kyiv, as our friends would correct me, sorry, in Kyiv in the Ukraine to meet with Volodymyr Zelensky. And then, of course, she more recently went off to Taiwan to really, I think, signal to the Chinese that the U.S. Congress is still behind Taiwan's independence. And then here she is again. She shows up in Armenia last week in a real kind of screw you to Vladimir Putin. And as a guy who is a huge supporter of Ukraine and a supporter of, I got to say, Joe Biden has done far better on Ukraine than I thought he might. And I'm just going to go out here on a limb, David, and say I think Joe Biden has done better on Ukraine than Donald Trump might have. Now, there's a whole lot of nuance there because there's some speculation that if Trump were in office, there would have been no anxiety on the part of Putin to invade Ukraine. I know this is sort of outside California politics, but it is a pet interest of mine. I just hate fascists, and I worry that we're in the 1930s again, and we're watching the rise of fascism in the Far East. The Far East and Eastern Europe. And so Nancy Pelosi shows up and I was really impressed. She reached out to Armenians, to Armenia, who are in a battle with the Russian-backed Azerbaijan government over a border dispute there. And Russia's not doing anything to calm things down. So Pelosi shows up and says, look, man, we're in this for freedom. We're in this for democracy. Azerbaijan, not Democrats. Vladimir Putin, not a Democrat, small d Democrat. Armenia, yeah. And California has huge and historic ties to Armenia. You know, for those of our friends who live in the Central Valley, especially in the wine-growing area, we know this, who live in Glendale up in L.A. County, we know this. Very big Armenian constituency in California. And perhaps this was just aimed at, you know, at that constituency, but it really struck me that this is a good move on her part. David, you have any thoughts? I know that people are already upset with me now for saying something nice about Nancy Pelosi, but give credit where credit is due.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I disagree with you, because I don't. She's on the right side of that issue. I guess I'm a little less impressed than you are. I don't. If it's a sign of bold moral courage today to show up in a country and say a few things 120 years later, then That's great. And even Biden's thing with Ukraine, I think he's on the right side of believing that Russia's invasion is inappropriate and securing the funding and defending what could happen with Article 5 of NATO and with other countries. I think, you know, he has a better feeling of the reality of global international order, but I think his idea that there was a deterrence that would keep Putin from doing so proved to be hopelessly naive. And that there's a lot before we got to this point that Biden could have done better. But I don't disagree with you. And that can be the case sometimes. And you and I do a good job, I think, of pointing out when people on the left end up on the right side of an issue, it needs to be said. And that is the corollary, by the way, to when people on the right are on the wrong side of an issue and we have to say so. That didn't happen a lot. In the first 20-something years of my adult life, I mean, there were moments that there were intramural debates about war and about economic policy and sometimes social policy, and I would take sides around the principles I believe in. But the idea of a really significant reshaping of the right, that's a newer thing going on, and it's playing out, and I think it's catastrophic. I think it could be fatal to the Republican Party. And give way over a generation, it wouldn't happen quickly, it would take a while, to the advent of a third party alternative. But I think that your point on the Democrats, anybody, Democrat or Republican, taking the side of moral clarity against fascism or authoritarianism, I'm all for calling it out. I'm not sure that what either Pelosi or Biden have done here is all that impressive.
Okay. I do think just, you know, I didn't put this in the show and on the run list for you, but I, you know, one of the things that constantly troubles me is to watch our friends on the left, you know, come out in full throated support of Ukraine against Russia, love all that. But here in California, we have the capacity to, I think, avert a real crisis in Europe, and that is by opening up drilling. Fracking, natural gas. We should be pumping this stuff out. We should be the arsenal of democracy in California. We have massive fossil fuel reserves in our state. And when I was in Europe, you know, the thing that kept coming up among people who I was interacting with was, you know, what we could really use from you guys is more energy, because Russia has, of course, shut down its natural gas shipments, its oil shipments to the West because of sanctions. And trying to pressure Europe as winter approaches, trying to really pressure Europe into a kind of economic crisis, push them into a corner to get the public opinion in Western Europe, get the public opinion turned against the war effort and start to cry, it's too cold, we need more energy. And here's California plotting, you know, loudly for Ukraine while basking in sunshine, but killing fossil fuel recovery in California. It frustrates me to no end.
But I mean, you could argue, Will, that it starts with a frustration nationally, because we could be producing out of the Permian Basin. We have the ability to convert natural gas into liquids and export. So there's the production that should be more, there's the processing that should be more, and there's the export capacity that should be more. And the only thing I would say is it starts with a federal frustration, and then you're adding on a California podcast why California could play a role in that. And I don't disagree with you. I'm totally with you. It's just simply that it is not going to happen. We can change the national mood, and we can change the policy for Texas, Oklahoma, Marcellus, Bakken production that will lead to greater exports of LNG to go to Europe. But it's not going to happen out of California. And so I would rather in the here and now focus on where we have a better chance of moving the needle. You go, well, why is it not going to happen? What if we go make the policy case or whatnot? I'm more referring to exertion. We need to flex on a scale of 1 to 10 up to a 2 to get this happening out of Texas, because the only thing holding it back is national.
Right.
And in California, we have to flex the same 2 nationally and then another 8 on the state side. You see what I'm saying?
Totally. Yeah, I totally agree. I guess, you know, this is more my I'm venting. I'm venting, and I'm just noticing the hypocrisy that we're willing to do certain things. But anytime Newsom recently, and we'll come to more energy conversation here in a moment, but anytime Newsom does anything to sort of acknowledge that maybe this all electric future is more problematic than he thought. I loved it when, you know, Trump was in the Oval Office, and after a year of not being able to make any headway, then 2 years, 3 years, 4 years on healthcare, said famously, who knew it was this complicated? That's Gavin Newsom every freaking day on energy policy. And if these people, our friends on the left in California, truly want to support Europe and support the war effort in Ukraine, they don't have to go shoot and die. They just have to sort of lighten up and recognize reality. And the reality is that we could become, America's the arsenal of democracy. That's been borne out here in this war effort. And we could do a lot more. But the fact is that Biden comes into office, and what's the first thing he does is kill the Keystone XL pipeline. And Newsom applauds this uproariously. So anyhow, end of international conversation, David. Let's talk about
that. Yeah, I think along those lines, though, Joe Manchin is a U.S. senator in West Virginia. He's not a state senator, right? He doesn't work in the West Virginia legislature. He works in the United States legislature in the greatest legislative body known as the United States Senate. And yet the entire reason that silly Schumer-Manchin bill got passed was that he threw in a guarantee to get the Mountain Valley Pipeline voted on. He viewed environmental policy as a hindrance to his state's economic growth, and he horse traded for basically an energy concession that would help his state. This is what I would be doing. Is California will eventually need U.S. senators that will recognize the ability they can leverage their own state's resources for a national and international opportunity. And that's what Manchin did to his own state's benefit. And it's actually, if it were standalone, I would have applauded it. He just tethered it to another bill that I hold contemptible. So there you go. That's politics, I guess. But what I would say that was interesting this week, and it wasn't a California congresswoman, is Rashida Tlaib in Minnesota?
Yeah.
I thought that's Ilhan Omar.
Oh, wait a minute. Omar. Michigan?
I don't know. One of these squad communist morons. They had all the U.S. banking people yesterday. And so, you know, Wells Fargo, San Francisco Bank, J.P. Morgan happens to not be. Bank One was Ohio-based, merged with Chase Manhattan, which is obviously Manhattan Bank. And you ended up getting J.P. Morgan, the most famous New York-based bank and national U.S. bank in history. She went after Jamie Dimon yesterday, Will, and said, will you commit that your bank will no longer fund any fossil fuel companies immediately? Now, remember, every one of these people has committed to a net zero 2050 policy. Now, that is not, people don't understand net zero. Net zero doesn't mean no more fossil tomorrow. It means getting to a point of net zero so that they believe in these carbon offsets along the way while you deal with the necessary reality of fossil. And I happen to think net zero is silly, and I think 2050 is silly, but I'm just defining it as different than saying let's cut off fossil tomorrow. Because these people are mostly grown-ups, and relative to these Congress folks and people like Gavin Newsom and others in California that are fighting this climate war in the way you and I are so disgusted by, they are really big grownups. So she says, will you commit to it? And Jamie Dimon responded, absolutely not. That is the surest way to guarantee the path to hell for America. So that is the only chance we have, since we're not going to get that U.S. senator that pulls a Manchin in Bakersfield assets, and we're not going to get a cultural movement away from extreme greenism in California anytime soon. It's corporate leaders that stand up to it. That's the only hope we have right now.
Yeah. So, David, let's talk about the immigrant issue, which I guess, you know, technically still is sort of international, but it greatly affects California, of course, the Southwest, and therefore all of America. And our listeners all know that Ron DeSantis out of Florida, Greg Abbott out of Texas have been moving immigrants, as they say, they have been bringing the border crisis directly to the Northeast folks who are most assertive of the rights of all illegal immigrants to come into the United States of America. So in one instance, Greg Abbott bussed and or flew immigrants up to, we have them up in Massachusetts. Was it Martha's Vineyard, I want to say? And then you've got immigrants showing up outside of Kamala Harris, illegal immigrants showing up outside of Kamala Harris's residence in D.C. All of this aimed at just sort of, as I said, bringing the border crisis direct to the people who are most aloof about the challenges that border regions, border states have really been playing in this migrant crisis, whether it's Florida and it's, call it a border with migrants coming in into Florida, but certainly Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, California, above all others. And fascinatingly, Gavin Newsom, of course, comes out and says immediately that he wants the Department of Justice to investigate, not Abbott, but DeSantis, clearly signaling his political concern here for 2024. The man who is not running for president only wants a DOJ investigation into what Ron DeSantis is doing and the flying of illegal immigrants up to Martha's Vineyard. He's outraged by all this, our governor is. Let me see if I can find this wonderful quote. This is nothing more than a stunt, but it's done with the cruel intention to humiliate and dehumanize children no older than the governor's children themselves, Newsom told the Bee, the Sacramento Bee. It's a disgrace. It's repugnant. And I would argue it's illegal. He says that he wants Attorney General Merrick Garland to investigate charges of kidnapping and fraudulent inducement. The Republican Party has crossed the Rubicon of decency, and he's accusing the Republican Party now of being functional authoritarians. Funny stuff coming from a guy who is now facing multiple lawsuits from conservative school boards, including Orange County's, to wind back the emergency authority that he is still using post-COVID to govern in California. Accusing others of authoritarianism is not something he should be bringing up, but of course his lackeys and throne sniffers love this stuff. So I'm intrigued by what's really seems to be going on here. He's talking an awful lot about Ron DeSantis and the immigrant issue, accusing him of a kind of authoritarianism, trying to link him inextricably to Trump. And it's been fascinating because what I think a lot of people may have missed, certainly if they, I would excuse them for missing it, I should say. Gloria Romero had a wonderful editorial. Let me see if I can find this thing here in my show notes. Here we go. Yeah, this was a piece that appeared in the Daily Mail out of the UK. And the headline is, I'm a Latina Democrat. And if progressives think that DeSantis appalls me, they're dead wrong. Gloria Romero was a state senator in California, a Democrat, longtime party leader, who has really kind of parted ways with her own party on issues of school choice. Most notably, she has been way in the front on charter schools and that sort of thing, school choice. And here she's saying that we really do need DeSantis and Abbott to raise this issue in the Northeast, where she claims to have knowledge that, you know, in her own community, the Latino community, that the Latinos do not universally support illegal immigration. You know, many of them, most of them are here legally, and they're just absolutely frustrated at the illegal immigration problem. And so she's taken a shot at Newsom. I wish that this piece had run in the American media rather than the wonderful Daily Mail. You know, David, I sort of watched this whole thing. I watched Newsom being theatrical in calling DeSantis theatrical. And of course, I guess that's just the nature of politics to some extent. But any thoughts on the migrant crisis here, David?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I support what DeSantis did, and I support what Abbott did, and I think it did indeed do what it was intended to do, which was shine a light on the leftist hypocrisy. But let's not pretend it wasn't theatrical itself. It was justifiable theatrics, but the idea that Newsom's coming back with something theatrical doesn't really bother me. It's the substance of it. Theatrical stunts seem to be the new norm in politics, and I just am not a very theatrical guy, and so I don't really like any of it, yet I recognize the world we're in right now. Your point is the good one. It's targeted at Newsom targeting it at DeSantis, and it's done so because there could be a Newsom-DeSantis run for presidency, and a lot of things could happen that could make that a reality. However, I believe that the notion of his strong defense of the babies maybe should be held up against the things he said about killing all the babies.
Why didn't I say that? Can we all just agree, even the listeners, that I said that line? I wish I'd said that. Yeah, thank you.
So he has been really theatrical lately on another topic, which is, we won't stand for this awful stuff from the Supreme Court. You know, you backward hick states that want to limit reproductive rights in Texas or Tennessee or something, that's fine. But here in California, we will salt poison your baby up until the birth, and we'll do Prop 1, and we'll do, you know, infanticide. I mean, we're going to have so many things on the menu for baby murder here that you're going to love us. And then the next time I saw him on TV, he was saying, oh my God, the poor babies. And I thought, wow, he went pro-life, you know? Like I thought, this is great. It turned out he was talking about the sin of putting a five-year-old on a plane to Martha's Vineyard. So I'm confused on all of it, man.
Dan Rather, who I sincerely thought
why are you bringing this guy up? Why do people bring up Dan Rather ever?
Because he has
become... I'd rather you not.
Yeah, really. I understand. That was really good. Did you make that up? He tweeted out an invitation at CNN saying, set up a debate one-on-one between Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis, two governors of big states, potential presidential candidates, prime time, ratings, I bet.
And he said at CNN, so he wanted to do it on neutral turf.
That's right. Yes. Who would have the courage to show up? And within seconds, here's Gavin Newsom. Hey, Ron DeSantis, clearly you're struggling, distracted, and busy playing politics with people's lives. Since you have only one overriding need, attention, let's take this up and debate. I'll bring my hair gel. You bring your hairspray. Name the time before Election Day. It was fascinating to read the comments of Newsom's supporters in reply to this. Because, of course, they believe that Governor Newsom will just, you know, wax the floor with Ron DeSantis. I'm not sure that's true, but I also just don't know about
them. Oh, of course it's not true. Ron would destroy Gavin.
Yeah.
Ron is an incredibly capable debater. Very quick on his feet. Very forceful. He's well-spoken. Look, Gavin's a handsome guy. I've said that many times. And then that's the end of my sentence. I don't have anything else to say.
Oh, man. Okay. So let's get back to energy a little bit. You know, we talked about this just a moment ago. You know, California could be the arsenal of the American arsenal of democracy. But we've had a heat wave in California. And you'll pardon me for, you know, I'm walking down the lovely streets of New York City today. And it's, you know, a blustery fall day with leaves cartwheeling down, you know, major boulevards like Lex. And it's just gorgeous out here. Fall has arrived. California is, you know, kind of still...
Lex is an avenue, not a boulevard. Come on now.
That's right. Oh, thank you. I meant boulevard with a small b. And what's fascinating is we've got Gavin Newsom now coming out and really trying to make the case that California avoided large-scale blackouts just because of all of his green initiatives, that's why we actually avoided the blackouts. Rather than seeing...
I got to interrupt real quick because I don't ever want it to be escaped upon us. One of my favorite things is Gavin Newsom talking about blackouts.
It is good.
Big drinker, Will. He was a big drinker.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did not know this. Is that right?
We've talked about it like four times on the podcast.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have short-term memory loss.
Each time you said, oh my God, I didn't know this. And each time you've been amused at me bringing up blackouts with Gavin, and then each time you forget, which leads me to believe that you are right now in a blackout.
I'm 62, brother. Brain not as plastic as it once was. But here's... After years of blackouts.
No, Gavin is... I've told this story before. He went to rehab for alcohol and then decided to drink again. But this time everything's okay. And it's never been called out for it in the media, ever. And I find it fascinating. But yes, blackouts come a lot in California for the reason you're bringing up. And I was interrupting with what I consider the ironic humor of the moment, given Gavin's past relationship with being a blackout drunk.
I do love it. Thank you. And you know what's great about having short-term memory loss, as I do, apparently, is this joke is funnier every time I hear it. It's as if I've never heard it.
You're hearing it for the first time every time you hear it.
Every time, yes. So here's a headline. This was, gosh, I think I saw this in Cal Matters, I want to say. No, this is CNBC, of all places. Newsom boasts California avoided rolling blackouts despite extreme heat and says his anti-green critics... Who are the anti-green critics primarily? Ron DeSantis. He says his anti-green critics want to double down on stupid. So here's his claim. He's talking to CNBC's Yasmin Coram, and he says the state's electricity demand almost reached a record of 52,000 megawatts. I don't know these numbers, so I'm going to skip most of the numbers. But he condemned criticism by the media. And Republican, I didn't see any criticism in the media, but maybe I'm not watching enough Fox and the governor is. He condemned criticism by the media and Republicans, such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, saying they want to double down on stupid and continue to drill and actually do more damage. He says the state avoided ordering rolling blackouts when electricity demand peaked in September from scorching heat, and he condemned claims that California couldn't keep the power on. It only reinforces that we've got to not just keep up what we're doing. We've got to jump ahead of Mother Nature and move this transition to a electric economy more aggressively. And we're committed to doing that. But the truth is, he says he was never panicked. These people are all doubling down. They're really bad. He kept saying this phrase over and over again. They want to double down on stupid. Somebody handed him, an index card with that written on it because he repeated it three times in the interview. So we want to move away from fossil fuels. We don't want to subsidize that problem we're trying to get out of. And what does he say made the difference? The electrification of the economy. That's how we got out of blackouts, ironically, and especially the extended lifetimes of backup generators. Here's the reality of what happened. And you know, we've talked about this on the show. And by the way, Newsom was supported in this claim by every major environmental group out there. They all said anybody who claimed that California was ever in trouble during the heat wave just doesn't understand how far California has gone in quote unquote clean energy. But here's the governor. We talked about this on the show. The governor was all over social media. He was on Instagram and Twitter, on TikTok. He was talking all about California's please, dear God, do not plug in your electric cars. Don't plug them in. I've made you buy these things. Do not plug them in or you'll bring down the entire Western grid. Here he is on Twitter. California is experiencing an unprecedented heat wave. This will be the hottest and longest on record. Our energy grid is being pushed to the max. The risk of outages is real. Now, this is just before, you know, he announces that he was never panicked, that everything was cool. We have this wired. Anybody who says we don't is an idiot. So what does he say on Twitter? We need everyone to double down to save energy after 4 p.m. today. Remember, there was this period, he said, between 4 and 9 when the sun goes down and the winds drop and we don't have enough renewables. So he was relying entirely on voluntary action to get people to unplug. He put out emergency orders, my favorite of which was that out on the ports of Long Beach, LA, San Francisco, and Oakland, he suspended the requirement that cargo ships coming in. Let me back up a second. When cargo ships come into California ports, they are required under law to turn off their diesel engines to maintain their electric facilities, which might be things like refrigeration, just the electricity required to run a ship, and to plug in instead. Cut off your diesel and plug into onshore electric sources. Instead, what Newsom says is, don't do that anymore. We've got a crisis right now. Go back to diesel. Don't forget that he also suspended the closure of Diablo Canyon, which would have been open in any case in this instance. But he was so panicked. He was everywhere. Here he is. We all have to double down on conserving energy. There's that phrase again. This is from his direct office, from his the governor's office. This is like an order that he puts out. He says, Californians have stepped up in a big way during this record heat wave, but with the hottest temperatures here now, the risk of outages is real. We all have to double down on conserving energy. We need everyone, individuals, businesses, the state, and energy producers to do their part in the coming days and help California continue to meet this challenge. Again, his point was, we're going to have outages unless people simply don't use electricity. That's not a plan. That's not building infrastructure. That's acknowledging that you have utterly failed to build the infrastructure you say we already have. I mentioned Diablo Canyon. I got other stuff here. But what's just fascinating to me, David, is the guy was clearly in a panic. There was one point at which I reposted his Instagram on Twitter in which he is wearing a cap and a, what do you call those little pull-up neck sweatshirts, because it's so cold in his office, apparently, that he's bundled up in a sweater. And he's telling people to turn down their air conditioning to 78. Don't keep on your air conditioning between 4 and 9. This was a man in total panic and flight, really understood what the reality was. And as soon as we beat the heat, because of voluntary action of citizens and businesses, he immediately declares that anybody who was panicked is a doomsayer doubling down on ignorance.
Well, there you go. I mean, a self-serving narrative from a politician about facts. I never heard of it. It's so silly, Will, as you point out. It's totally beyond the reality of the moment. And the only thing I would say, if it wants to encourage people, is there's nobody who believes that. Nobody.
Well, his heroes do. Read if you
ever
go. No,
but they would believe it. But we don't. They're not converts. They're just. They're running in place.
Fair point. I'm not going to talk at great length about this story, David. I included it in the notes that I sent to you. A really fine piece in the New York Times. The headline is "Red Flags for Forced Labor Found in China's Car Battery Supply Chain." The nut graph is they're using Uyghurs in concentration camps. The Chinese are. To mine rare metals that are necessary for the quote-unquote clean economy. So you've got mining, which the governor rarely talks about ever as necessary to the quote-unquote clean economy, because this is going to be a clean economy. There's no hurting the Mother Earth. We've talked about lithium mines in the Salton Sea, which are proposed now for mining, with major corporations jumping in line to get in there. But here's the nut graph from the New York Times story. China produces 3/4 of the world's lithium ion batteries, and almost all the metals needed to make them are processed here. Much of the material, though, is actually mined elsewhere in places like Argentina, Australia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Uncomfortable with relying on these other countries, the Chinese government has increasingly turned to Western China, that's where the Uyghurs are, has increasingly turned to Western China's mineral wealth as a way to shore up scarce supplies. So it's just a phenomenal piece, really looking at how these people have been marshaled into concentration camps with occasional peeps from the left about how bad this is. But the moment that we talk about the clean economy, we do not talk about Uyghurs anymore and their critical role in the global supply chain. Not you or I saying this, David. This is the New York Times. So, I just want to point out again, there is no such thing as clean energy. None of it. Not wind, not solar, not hydro, not nuclear, not oil, nothing. None of this stuff is clean. And the question is only sort of which incumbent business interest do you want to support? Which political theater do you want to promote?
Well, it's trade-offs. There is no perfectly clean energy. There are certain things that do have one pro and one con, and other things have a different pro and a different con. That's the story of economics. It's most certainly the story of energy and converting or transforming energy into something useful is a process that plays out throughout nature, and it has trade-offs embedded in it. And the environmental movement and the reasonable stewardship movement that I'm a part of and everyone else debating the issue for policy measures would all benefit from hitting a reset button around the reality of trade-offs.
You seem to be saying there's no free lunch. Can you open up the story, David? California Department of Finance warns of sharp revenue decline. This is actually straight out of the California Department of Finance. It's their monthly report. And it seems to have a bunch of bad news. Remember, you and I have talked about the fact that the governor keeps running around telling everybody, you'll certainly hear this among his most ardent fans, that California is such an effective place economically that the governor has managed to produce a $100 billion surplus last year on his budget. But here's the, you know, here's the reality. First of all, we've talked about the enormous debt in California now approaching $1.7 trillion, which would seem to wipe out on its face, if you're looking at this from a sort of a business standpoint, would seem to wipe out a $100 billion surplus. But here's the key line. Maybe there's three of them. California has a preliminary general fund agency cash receipts for August were $816 million, below the Budget Act forecast of $13.6 billion. I'll say that again. The receipts were $816 million against a forecast of $13.5 billion.
Something's off there, Will.
Yeah. You think?
No, I mean, I as a typo or something, those numbers can't be right.
You think
I can't be off by 95%.
That's what they're saying.
Where are you looking? That's not an article.
Look under monthly cash report, page 2 of the Department of Finance report. It says monthly cash report, the very first line. Do you see that?
Did you add this in the second email?
No, but I'm happy to...
No. Just tell me where it
is. Yeah, it's the headline is California sees warning sign from weak tax revenue.
Yeah, I've clicked that. It's a Bloomberg article.
Oh, shoot. Maybe I didn't put it on yours. I'm so sorry. Okay. So I have you at in a corner here. I'm so sorry. But the Bloomberg's article sources the Department of Finance bulletin that I'm referring to. I should have said that.
Yeah, they brought in $9.2 billion and were expecting which is $1.3 less than they projected.
Okay, so I'm reading directly from the report. I got different numbers here, but in any case,
it is. Hold up the report and tell me where you are.
Yeah, page 2, monthly cash report, first line. This is the beauty of doing this from 3,000 miles apart. I can't just hand you the documents. Sorry. Do you see it?
Yeah, so it says below the forecast of 10.5. Not that it came in at 1.2 and was supposed to be 10.5. But that it came in 1.2 below the 10.5.
You're looking at different numbers then, but...
No, I'm not. I'm looking at the same thing. You're just reading the grammar wrong. It's written awkwardly.
Okay. Tell me.
What they're saying is it came in 1.275 below the forecast of 10.5.
Okay.
Not that it came in at 1.275.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for the clarification, brother.
And so what you were suggesting is that they were off by 87%. And in reality, they were off at what the article accurately said was, I think, 12%.
Got it. Yeah.
Well, and they repeat it right there, Will. They do the math for you. In that first line that you're reading, they were $1.275 billion or 12.1% below the forecast. So you read it as the cash receipts were $1.275 billion, period. But what the sentence is that they disrupted with a poorly placed parenthetical phrase was they were 1.275 below the forecast of 10.5.
Yeah. Okay. We've got personal income tax receipts to the general fund below the month's forecast. Third consecutive month that was true. Corporate tax cash receipts were below the forecast. Third straight month that's happened. Sales and use.
So look, I can comment on this because I have a lot of experience in evaluating state tax receipts in my work as a muni bond investor. And I will tell you that July is not a generally particularly significant month. Quarterlies are usually paid in June and September. And obviously the annual true-ups are in April. If you are a partnership September, if you're on extension, and if you're personal on extension October. So July kind of fits right in the middle of these periods that is sort of worthless for income tax receipts. And yet it's the trend that is clearly concerning. Regardless of where the actual numbers come in, there's just simply no doubt that they are tracking towards a very big delta from their forecast. And July may not be the best indicator to validate it, but it is an indicator that combined with other year-to-date, with other dynamics, you know, it happens to be the first month of their fiscal year. But my point being, it doesn't look good. It's just that I wouldn't want to bank on this being something that is extrapolated, because it's a kind of outlier weird month, if you know what I mean.
I guess I do, but I'm confused, because as I read all this language, it says that these are the government's own monthly forecasts in their own budget. In other words, they've made these massive forecasts, and the actuals are far below the forecast.
They are. That's all true.
Okay.
It's just that what I'm saying is they are forecasting something that is kind of silly, an off month, and then they're coming up short of their own forecast.
And they'll make it up, you're saying, perhaps?
No, I'm not saying they're going to make it up. We don't know if they're going to make it up.
All right.
I'm just saying that, like, it's a month that you don't count on being significant in its revenue. And so being off in an insignificant month is different than being off in a significant month.
Got it. Okay. I'll take that, and we'll check back in when the quarterly numbers, which you say are going to be more accurate for us. We don't have a whole lot of time left here, David. Can I just get in one more subject area here on education? I think there's some really fun stories. So take a look under education here, and we've got three stories that I'd like to take a look at. I want to start with what I think is the most important one. This is a story. It's State Delays Public Release of English, Math, and Science. Did I send that one to you? I hope to God I did. Yeah, that was a late-breaking one. That came out last night, so I'm so sorry. Again, I have you at a disadvantage. There's a news website that is fairly moderate, liberal kind of website. It's called EdSource, and I recommend it to anybody who's interested in education reporting. And they sent in a Public Records Act request to the California Department of Education. That's Tony Thurman's deal. Tony Thurman, who is running again, he's the incumbent superintendent of public instruction for California. And so EdSource sends in a PRA, Public Records Act request, and they ask for the annual test score results for California's students. These are, you know, kids are taking these state mandated tests all year long, and then these numbers are supposed to come out annually. Well, we've got an election coming up. So Tony Thurman's office said, no, EdSource, we see that you want to see these numbers, but we're not going to give them to you. They're going to be released publicly at some point in the next year. Later this year. So here's the headline, the lead graph. In a significant departure, EdSource's John Fensterwald and Thomas Peel write, in a significant departure, the California Department of Education is withholding the release of the results of the Smarter Balanced tests students took last spring until an undetermined date later this year. The denial of EdSource's request to release the data comes at a time when educators are concerned about the pandemic's impact on reading and math progress, especially in the early years. Releasing scores later this year means the public will learn about spring test results for third graders who are now well into the fourth grade, and it means they'll be withheld until after the November election. So Tony Thurman, who is running this department and has the capacity to actually be able to insist that this public document be made public, has said nothing. And so far, the major media, the LA Times, the SACB, the Chronicle, you name it, no major media outlets have covered this. They've just been sort of pounding on the usual Lance Christensen, the Republican in a nonpartisan, a conservative in the nonpartisan race running against Tony Thurman. They've been really focused on, what does Lance Christensen think about abortion? What does he think about Trump? Rather than this kind of nuts and bolts issue of how well is Tony Thurman doing in the job. To their great credit, EdSource quotes Thurman opponent Lance Christensen saying, the fact that the department is not willing to publish now suggests the scores will be far lower, and the current state superintendent does not want to be held accountable for his results. We're at California Policy Center. We're taking a look at the possibility of filing suit and joining EdSource, we hope, in a suit that would perhaps compel the release immediately of this data. I mean, I think that this is important for the public to know as we head into an election. Anything you want to add to that before I get into
The only thing I want to say is you've done the micro, and you're 100% right. And I just want to cover the macro that what they're doing to Lance is the playbook that they should be doing in every race around the country, is divert attention away from the local reality of a bad candidate or bad policy and turn it into a story about Trump.
Right.
Then what the right does is, instead of resisting it and saying, hey, no, we want to focus on education, on kids, on freedom, on Lance, on bottom-up reality, the right says, oh, you want to make it about Trump? Okay.
Yeah, Exactly.
They play right into it. And so this is a, to me, kind of a microcosm of a larger political reality. It is sound political strategy to try to nationalize a local school race filled with arguments for Lance and against Thurman. And it is strong political strategy to try to make that about Trump. Right?
Yes, absolutely.
So what do we do? What do we do? We're supposed to not let that happen. I'm done.
Yeah, I'm delighted that you keep underscoring this point, because it is true that the left wants to make this election all about Trump, and so too do too many of our friends on the right. David, I'll close probably, I guess, with this story. This was actually a story that was broken by a, we used to call them bloggers. Now it's a person on social media who runs the Parent Union social media account, UTLA, that's United Teachers Los Angeles Uncentered. She found that LA Unified's school district had posted a bizarre video about food neutrality. And I sent you, David, the story by good old Katie Grimes at California Globe. That headline is LA Unified School District Posts Bizarre Video About Food Neutrality. What is food neutrality, David? Food neutrality, according to LAUSD, is an anti-racist campaign. The argument here that LAUSD put out on its own website and then later denied that it had put it out on its own website, which is itself a story. Somebody apparently hacked the LAUSD website and all their social media accounts. Food neutrality is the notion among anti-racists, so-called, that anybody who judges, Twinkies worse for you than tomatoes or oranges or apples or broccoli is clearly a racist. They're making racist judgments. You don't have to go back too far to remember that when Michelle Obama was in the White House, she legitimately, reasonably tried to use her bully pulpit to encourage gently kids to grow their own vegetables, their schools, and eat more vegetables and fresh fruit and stay away from high sugar sodas. It was a non-coercive, very voluntary kind of campaign. I loved it. A lot of our friends on the right had to say that if Barack Obama or his wife have anything to do with American politics, we're against it. She was right. But now the left is coming out with this food neutrality thing, in which the women on the the LAUSD site say food choices are based on a false standard of health. We are incorrectly taught from a young age that our size and therefore the foods that we eat are markers of our self-worth. The two women in the video are Blair Imani, who says diet culture based on oppression has created false hierarchies of food. So this is a person who has been an activist on the left for a long time, David, and I know that you are a health Nazi these days. You're a good man. You're looking good, brother, by the way, even from a distance of 3,000 miles. You look really good right now.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'm working hard, my friend.
I know you are. So anyway, there are two stories here, really. One is that I had no idea that there was such a thing as food neutrality. I had no idea that LAUSD was putting this stuff out, this crap out, I would say. You know, we really do need to encourage kids all the time to eat well. That's the job of a parent. That's one of the things we sign up for when we make a baby. So I was intrigued by that. And then I was intrigued that when she tried to get a response from LA Unified, Katie was told, late Wednesday afternoon, this is last Wednesday, not yesterday, Wednesday, or 2 days ago, Wednesday. Late Wednesday afternoon, we heard back from LAUSD asking us to attribute the comment to an LA Unified spokesperson. To our knowledge, the social media content in question did not originate from an employee at LA Unified. We support the highest nutritional standards for our students and continue to ensure that all social media content promotes a safe and welcoming and affirming learning environment for all. So there's LA Unified saying, we didn't do this. We didn't put this out on our own social media accounts. So that's a follow-up that I'd love to see maybe Katie Grimes or somebody do. We're doing it here. We're saying, apparently, LA Unified's social media accounts have been hacked by radicals who are putting out a message which LA Unified does not support. That should be the headline in the LA Times tomorrow, by the way. David, I think it's all the time we have today. What do you think?
I know it's all the time I have.
Okay, can you give me one quick response to the question? USC versus Oregon State Saturday evening?
We win and cover.
All right. Thank you, David. I feel good about that. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it's easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. And please, dear Lord, rate and review this show. That helps others find us. You can email us your comments and story suggestions. You'll find our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes, including links to these stories. You can follow us on Twitter, also at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host Dave Bonson, we give thanks as ever to session producers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, our researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian, and all of our friends at National Review, but especially National Review's podcast producer, Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.